If you go down on this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
It's society. They work for each other. They pay each other. They buy houses. They get married, make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
Can I wait for the episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire where all the contestants team up and they overpower the host and they share the money?
The message of Occupy Wall Street is I would prefer not to play the existing game.
We are a socialist party and there are social solutions to the problems.
Communal lifestyles, I don't know about that.
No one can tell me what to do.
Wow, you're a real anarchist.
Didn't know we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
No words for you puppets of the West. Communism forever.
God, those communists are amazing.
Hello, welcome to the Three Left Show live in the studio. I am your host, Dan Platt. This program covers news, issues, and anything of interest from a radical and revolutionary left perspective for the curious or the committed, posting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy, a left that is of itself and for itself, the meeting point of socialism, anarchism, and ecology. This show proudly waves the flags of the three lefts. Welcome. And what bigger problem do we have? Then the question of how do we actually change the government? Because to me, it is not a question of reform versus revolution. Now, I just said radical and revolutionary. They are the same thing to me. They are the same, reform versus revolution, because historically speaking, the big reforms don't happen without so-called revolutions. Revolutions are merely the means of making reforms happen. French Revolution. Liberal reforms. American Revolution. It's how we started doing liberal reforms. Creating the framework of liberalism. The framework that would eventually overtake slave economies. And so on. This episode, to continue on with the intro, but mostly also segueing into the first topic, we'll talk about the CHAZ/CHOP, the autonomous zone in Seattle. May it rest in peace. It has been dismantled by the state, by the pigs, the cops, and what else? As well as just its general structure and limitations. Then I will cover worker organizing, organizing issues in general, and general observations, and a one-man, I'm alone in the studio at the moment, discussion of how to organize going forward. A question that is covered more or less constantly on the left or in left-leaning spaces, something that is debated in various ways. For example, one way that I can cover quickly is the coalition building side. Conversation happening between the Rising's Kristen Ball and her conservative compatriot, whose name I haven't memorized, but he's like an arch-conservative guy, versus Nathan Robinson of Current Affairs. The whole, like, does the left, populist left, that we're not calling ourselves revolutionary, radical, or even socialist. No, we're just the populist left as far as certain ex-democratic operatives like Kristen Bell, Ball, I think her name's Ball, would say. We need to work with the populist right, a.k.a. the fascists. But still, since we're both anti-establishment, that's apparently enough to form a relationship of convenience. Now, relationships are of convenience. My hypothesis is that it's normal for the right to do this, but it is not for the left. It's kind of fake bullcrap to the left, because kind of doing so goes against our values of inclusion. Because doing it as a matter of convenience, usually convenience means you, actually what it is seeing things as transactional relationships, like in the marketplace, that we meet each other as strangers, we exchange currency, maybe I get more value from it than you, someone has to be exploited somewhere along the way, even if two business partners both win, hypothetically. That is a relationship of convenience. When you have actual principles, values, and goals, and a vision of society that is based on equity, maybe not based on market relationships, you don't see things, or you do not want to see things, as mere transactional relationships. Do we view marriages as transactional relationships anymore? Do we view any of our relationships, be they intimate, personal, friendships? To view everything, such things as transactional, is usually frowned upon because there's less social labor going on. It usually leads to abuse. And being in a transactional relationship with the populist right, aka fascists, then there's definitely going to be abuse later. Especially with people who don't view democracy as something that's valuable, then of course we're not going to share the same party or movement. There's just going to be a lack of trust, as there usually is in organizations. More and discuss that as I go forward. You know, sometimes there's a question of how much of a contradiction you're willing to put up with. And so many contradictions abound when you're in a relationship of convenience. We want things to make sense. And that doesn't happen personally speaking, if we're kind of coming at things like you have to judge every relationship you're going to have with every group or every person based on the available evidence. There's a reason we have these bias mechanisms of political correctness to judge whether somebody is coming from somewhere that we can understand and work with. Now, the thing about the fight against political correctness and the ability to think for yourself and not form tribes, groups, or, you know, organizations means that we're kind of all alone. We're all kind of left to our own ways of trying to figure out meaning who our allies are. And that is very difficult, if not impossible, to do alone, without thinking or being in a society of our own choosing or our own making. So there's generally lots of advice I hear online or elsewhere, you know, in the commentariat and mainstream media, or even, you know, independent media, that there's, you know, the left needs to learn from the right because the right seems to work together better because they do in fact value strict, unequitable hierarchies. They can take orders, even if they don't particularly like them, though usually do like them. And of course, you know, usually this advice is so the left can win. But then it becomes a question of what are we winning? Winning capitalism? We don't want to win capitalism. We want to win something else. We want to do something else. Then there's the matter of, you know, we want to win at community building or our own personal relationships. You know, when, say, one wins elections, we're winning the management of capitalism. Let's say we get that big social democracy movement. Because as far as, say, you know, America, we're not going to have another civil war, another big, this violent revolution thing. Because, see, those things occurred in states where there were not, well, when I say state, I mean countries, nations, whatever, areas, where there wasn't a modern state. So when people wanted political change, it had to be violent. It had to be this complete overthrow, or rather it was able to be, because political, threat of violence was the only thing that, say, those regimes had, like in Russia. But counter that, in, say, industrialized countries like the UK, France, Scandinavia, America, we did have a revolution of the same type, but it came in the form, rather, it didn't come in the form. The result was social democracy, the New Deal. The New Deal was gained and passed in America because there were massive labor strikes. In fact, probably the same level of activity, radical, revolutionary, militant, as there was during the Russian Revolution. But because it was struggling with a modern nation state, right, with an army that wasn't collapsing in on itself, the results were, of course, different, perhaps more moderated. It wasn't a violent overthrow. Is that the kind of thing we're going to have again? I lean towards that, since we are still in that modern nation state. If anything, it's a more advanced form of it. What with the surveillance technology and whatnot. Surveillance, secret police could only dream of. So moving back to the Chaz, autonomous zone in Seattle, to further the questions of organizing and such. So I'm going to start with a reference to a video that I will link in documentation later when I post the podcast version of this episode on the site 3lefts.news and on the Facebook page 3lefts show. A video by Thought Slime, YouTuber, bread tuber, left tuber, whatever, where he interviews someone who kind of stayed at the shop and she stayed there for a week. And so giving her experiences of how things worked on the ground. And her experience, her description, though she didn't seem to have all the theoretical language to, which I might have, she described everything almost as just being mutual aid groups. So there did not even seem to be the horizontal organization that Occupy encampments had. Maybe because it lasted even a shorter amount of time, about a month, versus the 2 months that Occupy encampments lasted, some even longer than that. So what are the differences? So from her description, everything was kind of done ad hoc. It was kind of as you go. Everything was kind of done in small groups, as mutual aid is done. Small groups of 5 to 10, usually a group of friends, doing one thing. As usually most projects are carried out these days, and when we talk about what is grassroots, it's a small group coming together usually to complete one task. The task could be delivering water. The task could be planting a garden. It could be setting up the shop that was at the chop, which was kind of a free store. Free store being just tables of things laid out, which included bagged food, preserved food, groceries of various types, canned goods, and toiletries, and so on, all available through donation or just gathered up via, you know, $100 purchases at a time. So here's from, let's see, anarchistnews.org. In the autonomous zones. So this covers the CHOP, but also talks about a few other autonomous zones. So this is where we can broaden our discussion and from the news of the day to something a little deeper. At first, they called it the CHAZ of Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. In early June, protesters aligned with the Black Lives Matter movement took over 6 city blocks of a gentrified Seattle neighborhood. There, activists screened films, served spaghetti, painted murals, held vigils, and planted a community garden. And that's the thing, activism versus organizing. They're not the same thing. Activism is 5 people getting together and doing a particular task. The task could be lobbying local government. It could be holding a rally. Could be one of the things described here. Their demands, according to Dai Sheik Kim Jr., 28, an organizer who lives in the neighborhood, are defund the Seattle Police Department by half, fund more social services in the city, and drop chant charges against all protesters. Quoting, "We firmly believe that the type of leverage that we have during this moment would not be made possible if it wasn't for the on-the-ground protesters who are there every night putting that type of visible strategic pressure on the city," Mr. Kim said. Jenny Durgan, the mayor of Seattle, initially praised the zone as predominantly peaceful. How nice. Even while the idea of the area becoming a culture war punching bag for pundits and politicians. See Fox News for what that looks like. On June 20th, a 19-year-old there was shot and killed. Many began leaving the zone. Ms. Durkin issued an executive order on Tuesday calling for the area to be vacated, noting reported life safety, public health, and property issues. Businesses in the area filed class action lawsuits against the mayor. All told, and by the way, this class action lawsuit, this doesn't go into the details, but it was for costs. I think something not mentioned here was the whole give an inch, fall into the trap that the state builds for you. Occupy, I don't think. Well, the thing between, like, when you're in an autonomous zone, when you're actually trying to create your own zone of control, first of all, it couldn't have been done as disorganized as this was. It can't be done with mutual aid. There needs to be some type of command and control hierarchy. There just needs to be something. some kind of organization. Now, Occupy had such an organization. We had a de-escalation squad, but that was for internal security. We did not have an outward-facing security. Why? Because after the second week, maybe even after the first week. No, maybe it was the second week. Second or third week. The NYPD had, and I'm talking about Zuccotti Park in New York City where I was, the police had already surrounded the park. Like, they see the Chop and the Chaz, they put up barricades to keep the police out. With Occupy, the police would set up barricades to keep us in, or at the very least, control the flow of who goes in or out. That's why we didn't really have any of the problems of shootings, assaults, or what have you. There were fights inside, that's why we needed the escalators. But why did we have fights? Because the cops would arrest people, take their medications, whatever they may be, and then release them, and then they wouldn't have their meds, and so they would be, you know, unstable. That was at least one of the stories. So in giving an inch, the city asked the protest to give up one of its blocks, which was more of a main thoroughfare, so traffic could go through, the precious traffic, car traffic. And what this allowed, there was now a line of sight closed to the protest. They did not have full control over the space. The space was now no longer defensible. Not really from the police, right, who weren't a direct threat or weren't directly threatening the protest. But then there were right-wingers, militia types, Proud Boys, who were. And this allowed them to conduct a number of drive-bys, drive-by assaults, and then eventual shooting, which then became the catalyst for the final crackdown. This would not have been possible if they didn't give up the inch and fought the city on keeping that thoroughfare closed, which is why it was probably taken in the first place. But then it becomes a matter of where's your dividing line, right? You give up this road to buy yourself some time to have another 3 weeks of this existing. But it's still existing then as a shadow because now it's unsafe and more people are not going to be coming. It's not going to be as vibrant. There's going to be less people being recruited to do stuff, even if it's, say, the one task, the one project. You're not going to be more organized without that base of people who are there, physically or not, even. Occupy had that base of people, mostly because of the stability of the space, that it was just the park or a park. And we didn't have the threat of, we didn't have the right-wing ascendant movement at the time. That's what's changed in the last decade. Since renamed the Capitol Hill Occupied protest, its holdouts spent a week preparing a last stand. Quote, "We fought to take this place, and we will fight to the end," an activist told the crowd on Saturday. On the morning of July 1st, police swarmed in the Chop, removed barricades, arrested more than 30 people, and loaded tents and debris into garbage trucks, citing, quote, "ongoing violence and public safety issues." General point is that the police are an ongoing public safety issue, as well as general poverty. But hey, that's a different, that's completely different. "From our perspective, elected officials seem to only care about violence that affects black people when it's politically prudent for them," Mr. Kim said. The emergence of CHOP comes amid new attempts at autonomous zones, including one in Richmond, Virginia, Philadelphia, and New York City. But activists have been transforming neighborhoods into short-lived protest camps for at least a century, opening brief portals into alternative social political realities. Some have had happier endings. "One simply wants to live happily, differently, with the parameters of what's possible," says Kristen Ross, a professor of comparative literature at NYU, who wrote a book about the 1871 Paris Commune. Quoting her, "It's about a strategy where you develop the institutions on your own," she said, "the goal being to develop the collective capacity to take care of yourself." This is why they kind of changed the name from Autonomous Zone, because they were not going to be autonomous. Not by means of electricity, water, food, whatever. They're not autonomous, so why call themselves that? They're not even separate from the grid, because this is close to the downtown neighborhoods. For background, the Paris Commune occurred in March of 1871 when left-wing Parisians expelled the French army from the city and began a brief experiment in socialist rule. Their methods remain familiar. The Parisians famously toppled the statue of Napoleon in the Palace Vendôme. The people of Paris just kind of took over the mechanisms of the city and thought, We can run this better in our own interests, a CHOP organizer told Roar magazine. I see this as part of that tradition and a part of that lineage. Further context for the Paris Commune. How were local socialists and unions able to take control of Paris? Well, the French army was able to be driven out because they had just been defeated by the German army, or rather the Prussian army, in the war between them, where France lost Alsace-Lorraine, and, you know, continuing animosity that goes until the First World War, and so on and so on. Like, Paris had been just besieged by the Prussian army, or combined German army. And so, yeah, it was kind of a big opportunity. The big power vacuum was made. But then the French army regrouped, and between then 6,000 and 50,000 people died. It's a very large gap in numbers. The state response also has echoes today. There will never be an autonomous zone in Washington, D.C. as long as I'm your president, President Trump tweeted in June 23rd, after activists tried to set up the so-called Black House autonomous zone near the White House. If they try, they will be met with serious force, tweeter-in-chief. But what's an autonomous zone? Well, the term's meaning is slippery. Definitions are always contentious, says Timothy Miller, a professor of religious studies, University of Kansas, but the author of Communes in America, 1975 to 2000. Autonomous zones are really temporary for the most part and tend to be protest camps. They're not intentional communities or communes, Mr. Miller said. For me, an intentional community is a group of people gathered around a common purpose, whether it be religious, social, typically, with the intention of being there for a long time. Today, there are hundreds of intentional communities in America listed in just one database, including farming-focused eco-villages and a dancing sanctuary for people with PTSD. Yet even these boundaries are porous. There are in-between cases that have features of intentional communities and temporary autonomous zones, Mr. Miller said, pointing to the Occupy Wall Street encampment in Manhattan as one such example. I took part in that, though I didn't live there, but I spent 2 days a week there. The term temporary autonomous zone was popularized in 1991 by an anarchist theorist named Peter Lambert Wilson, better known as Hakim Bey, who published a manifesto that cited a possibly imaginary 18th century network of outlaw pirate utopias and the anarchist liberated zones from the cyberpunk author Bruce Sterling. Okay, yeah, so in this manifesto, he lists a number of possible examples of these autonomous zones, be they the areas that pirates in the Caribbean controlled for about 4 years. Generally, that's like, it's called a golden age. Age is a little bit of a misnomer. It was like a decade. It was like a good decade where it was like at its height. And then the state came down and killed them all through state terror and whatnot. I got two books on it. Let's see. Mr. Bay theorized that the internet would help bring about impermanent free enclaves where culture could spread outside of state control. Mr. Bay's conception of anarchy estranged him from some others. He had published work in the Journal of the NAMBLA Group. Oh, boy. The theories prefigure the temporary enclaves that have bubbled up this month, even as they're snuffed out within weeks, days, or even hours. Those are the best autonomous zones, said Emekel. And this is like an internet tagline name, by the way. So it's 62, who founded a small rural Wisconsin anarchist community called Dreamtime Village with Licks-ish, that's a real name, in 91. Many self-identified anarchists changed their names. Oh, you don't say. It doesn't have to keep fighting to do its thing because it's already over. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. Dreamtime Village, which has sometimes billed itself as a permanent autonomous zone, became a destination for nomads traveling America's back roads, he said. And nearly three decades later, the community is still going strong. Asked what lessons activists elsewhere may learn from his longevity, he emphasized the value of consensus. Often, he said, something, by the way, I just paused there because I'm kind of an expert on consensus by now. Often, he said, this community draws people in the early 20s who are especially issue-driven, whether they're militant vegans or animal rights activists. In order to prevent any individual from derailing important meetings, Dreamtime self-governance requires consensus minus one, meaning that a single person can't block a decision-making process. That is something that Occupy did not do, which it should have. It's one of those lessons to learn. Do consensus, but make sure it isn't just one person vetoes. Because that way, one undercover cop can ruin your day and week. The long back and forth of history. Early in the morning of January 5th, 1969, a young Irish Republican named Liam Hillen painted the words, "You are now entering Free Derry," on the gable of an abandoned house in the Bogside neighborhood of Derry, his native city. Mr. Hillen spent the night at a protest, which was inspired by the American Civil Rights Movement, and grew angry after watching police and loyalists beat Republicans with batons and rocks. Painting the sign was an act of resistance. What we were actually doing was just declaring, "You're now entering Free Derry, pal, and this is us, and you are not in control." Quoting him in 2009. That summer, locals erected barricades and pushed police and loyalists out of their neighborhood, in a clash known as the Battle of the Bogside. Residents of Free Derry organized their own security patrols and public transit. It was probably done by, like, having a few vans or a van and then taking shifts driving it around. That's how I imagine it. The barricades went up and down over the next few years after a prolonged period, quoting, "The British Army were nipping at the edges of Free Derry and coming into it in mass and heavily armed patrols and armored vehicles." The manager of the Museum of Free Derry, "This was two sides at war." In early 1972, British forces killed 14 unarmed civilians. The Bloody Sunday massacre transformed Free Derry into a global symbol of resistance. In 2010, the British government released the results of its inquiry into the killings, and people in Gaza flew the Irish flag. In this month of Seattle, someone set up a wooden sign in tribute to Derry near the barricades, "You are now entering Free Cap Hill." One of the criticisms that could be laid against the hard left is that they talk a good revolution. They never do it, Mr. Kern said. Quoting him, "Autonomous zones are where people have actually got up and done something. It might not succeed, it might not last long, but it's not talking, it's action." This was something in particular I was annoyed at, where we were, like, in Occupy, having assemblies, meetings, doing protests every day, and new working groups were being formed every week. And you would have people in the assemblies going, like, "We're doing too much talking. We need to act." And I think the counterpoint that would generally be brought up in the same conversation was, we are acting. We're acting all the time. Our very standing here is an action. To have a big public assembly meeting that isn't sanctioned by some authority, that's positive. "My advice for activists in Seattle is to know that we stand with you," McLeod of McLaughlin, a Derry resident and former Sinn Féin assembly member, wrote in an email, "Know that the eyes of the world are on you. Know that one of the key catalysts for the long campaign for justice for the murders on Bloody Sunday was that the world's media flashed images across the world of the denial of rights, of police brutality, and ultimately of murder, direct and cruel." And now to wrap up about the exhausting practice of consensus, something so important to all of these lasting communes. Perhaps the largest experiment in autonomy today is taking place in the sliver of land in northeastern Syria, where a collection of Kurdish-led militias have fought off ISIS, Turkey, and Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria. The autonomous region of Rojava follows the teachings of a revolutionary socialist named Akhilan Asalan. I already talked about him two episodes ago, but now more about their government, their reform policing. "The best self-defense is strong community relationships," they wrote. "Don't lose sight of the long-term goals. Celebrate every victory. Love your comrades. You may have to do things less heroic and more difficult than you imagine." Because decision-making by consensus, it can be quite a slog. But the results are well worth it, especially when done with a trained facilitator, someone who knows what they're doing. It seemed like our facilitation team did know what they were doing to some extent, but then they said they were using a modified consensus, which was actually a worse version of it. Imagine. Now a different perspective on, but also another mention of a type of autonomous zone. The other one that comes to mind is Chrislandia, and there's some good YouTube videos on that place. But this is from a guy from a, I'm going to assume, right-wing libertarian think tank, based on what he advocates for and, like, how Chaz isn't the autonomous zone we really need. you know, a place where everyone shares everything. No, we need one that's completely market driven. That's what freedom is. Freedom for money, people, freedom, people with money. But I'm going to read the first half because that's where he talks of Christianity, and it's an interesting one other point. The dream that was Chaz, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone in Seattle, has evaporated nearly as quickly as it originated. After three different shootings, leaving one man dead and three wounded, the experiment in police-free self-governance is ending. Though it didn't have a government, and that was kind of mentioned by that YouTube video I mentioned earlier in the hour, that there was not a formal governance structure. There was this de facto leader, but it was really just, I think, more of a misnomer of the person who spoke the best and who was the spokesperson. That's the thing about spokespeople. They're usually seen as the leaders of something when they're not. Like, say, with the Green Party. Our presidential candidate is kind of like when, like, say, when the major parties, when they elect a president, that person is the head of the party. And they usually stay the head of the party. At least another cycle, especially when, say, that party is out of office. You know, Obama is still considered the head of the party, even though, you know, he's not president. He's mostly checked out, but he's still sending letters out, fundraising stuff. With minor parties or other organizations, there's a separation of powers, more so than the major parties or our government has, in that our presidential candidate is like our main spokesperson. Like, they're not the leader of the party. There's a usual confusion, or at least, like, a kind of people, maybe there's an expectation, and that muddles things, because then people aren't like, well, what's this person in the, you know, the committee, the national committee doing? Like, well, they're the leadership. Like, really? I didn't vote for them. You know, it's like, well, I thought Jill Stein was the leader. That's the person, if people, you know, associate someone with the Green Party, it will be the spokesperson, the presidential candidate. But I need to kind of tell people, and it kind of clears things up for them to say, our presidential candidate is our spokesperson. We pick them based on that. The criteria we pick our presidential candidate is sometimes platform related, but it's really more like, are they the good speaker? Are they an organizer? Like, how do they come across publicly? So there's some optics, you know, questions and whatnot. So back to this first paragraph where they never quite figured out what autonomy requires of an autonomous zone, right? An actual governance structure for one. So yeah, that's what seemed to be missing, that there was all this mutual aid happening, completely grassroots, completely ad hoc. You know, there's actually this type of anarchist practice called ad hococracy, which is just, you know, just a name to put on when everyone's just kind of doing things ad hoc, doing everything task by task. Just do what is necessary. Keep things simple, keep things small. But then questions of infrastructure and then actual, like, collective work come into play, and then that's when things fall apart. And so it's like, well, it seems like those ideas of just doing mutual aid isn't enough. And that's my critique of most, like, just plain anarchists. And lately, with the way the movement is and the way I'm observing things, I'm getting less anarchist by the day. This is still the Three Left Show. All right. Anarchism's never going to be gone as part of, like, thinking in terms of horizontal organization. And that's what this program today is more talking about, that it is done well. And in this case, with Chrislandia, so now let's talk about Chrislandia. Why is this a good example? Let's find out. Okay, but what if they had figured out autonomy? What was the point anyway? Chaz's external critics and advocates both focused from the outset on its police-free, protest-based raison d'etre. But the zone's de facto leader and its most vocal occupants envisioned a future of pure equality, peace, and perpetual celebration, like a festival block or a festival district. They sounded more like aspiring founders of a U.S. version of Chrislandia, the half-century-old infamous or famous squatter-turned-anarchist enclave in Copenhagen, Denmark. That is basically a rules-based commune wholly dependent on services from the city from which it pretends to be independent and largely ineffectual as source of meaningful reform. since it wasn't founded as a protest. When I visited Crystallandia 2 years ago, I was struck both by its colorful peacefulness and its general dinginess. It is orderly, owing to the rules that are adopted by the full assembly of its roughly 900 residents. Its centerpiece, Pusher Street, is famous for its open-air drug market that bans the hard stuff but offers a wide variety of cannabis products, largely, though not always, without violence and theft. Its residences, mostly converted military buildings, have the look and smell of a budget summer camp. There are no signs of any real economic progress or dynamism during its 50 years, because that really isn't the point. It exists as an alternative to the governing status quo, a communal destination for dropouts, hippies, and nonconformists. Now, Crystallandia is, and the reason why it's the squatter community with military barracks, military buildings, is because that's what it used to be. It was a military base that was put on the outline of the old Copenhagen walls, like from the Renaissance, that like the Star Fort, you know, if you know what Star Fort looks like. Copenhagen had the Star Fort walls, but, you know, with modernity, you take them down, but they're public land that was military use, so they put a military base on it. Then by the 70s, no need for a military base in the city or, you know, in the area, so it was abandoned. And thus, squatters came in, and because, like, it literally still has the moat around it, or at least on one side, it had a kind of physical separation as well. Crystallandia originated in 1971 in a less volatile conditions than Chaz, as squatters peacefully moved into the empty army base and declared it autonomous zone. The original inculcate aspirations of Chaz occupant sounded similar to what Crystallandia is doing today, though. A nonviolent haven of equality, more artist commune than commercial district, that provides an alternative to the police-backed governance of the prevailing city. What this really means is Chaz would have become a rules-dominated community, unable to exist without its host city. Immediately upon declaring independence, Chaz residents got busy making rules, as our anarchists do, when they finally get control over something. Crystallandia may be a pure democracy, or arguably stricter, than those opposed by the average Copenhagen resident, and yet a sizable part of Crystallandia's population works in the city of Copenhagen. They'd be working in Greater Seattle because rules-based communes are not typically as economically self-sufficient. I mean, what can be these days? Finally, as the recent tragedies in Chaz demonstrate, they're not tragic, but I mean, they're caused by this, you know, the situation I explained. When violence or fires break out, an autonomous zone's dependence on the host city's first responders becomes all too apparent. Well, no, that wasn't the case, because in one of the shootings, the police refused to escort the ambulance in. So the ambulance could have gotten in, but didn't. And so it was up to the medics on scene, who were part of Chaz, and a private car to get that person to the hospital. Despite its obvious limitations, there was a meritocracy nugget buried in Chaz's fluid, confused beginning. You can see, like, what this guy values based on, like, his seems to have this negative tone about rules-based. See, they adopted rules. Not so high and mighty now, are you? Not to mention the... It's like, they're even stricter than regular, liberal society. Not the most honest writer here. Despite its obvious limitations, there is a, you know, and meritocracy, of course. But compared to cities that have grown dysfunctional and in some cases unjust because of how powerful interests, including the police in some places, control, include capitalists in those powerful interests, apparently, because that's who he thinks need to be in charge. Or rather, it's the ANCAP delusion that without the state, monopoly power doesn't exist, and then capitalists don't accumulate wealth. And, you know, I discussed this with Michael last episode, how markets actually work, whether there's a government or not. In fact, usually when the government is absent, that's when the monopoly power becomes its strongest. That's laissez-faire capitalism. Anyway. The media, I'm not here to debunk right-wing stuff, okay? I'm here to discuss how to do left-wing stuff better. There's enough people making content about dumb right-wingers. Cities, especially progressive ones, have been allowed with impunity to impose new forms of redlining on low-income and minority residents through NIMBY-based zoning and land-use policies. True. Combined with lousy schools, where qualified immunity everyone is now talking about with police can now be seen on full display, and unjust policing, the promise of urban life for low-income residents is too often out of reach. Chaz and Chrislandia are interesting, maybe illegal, slideshows of this story. I love how he has to bring up they're illegal. I mean, of course they're illegal. They become legalized by taking a stand and then negotiating something with the city. That's what happened with Chrislandia. And should a protest encampment become established enough, permanent enough, and self-sufficient enough, okay, not completely, of course, but enough, like usually a squatter movement is become self-sufficient enough, then you negotiate with the city to basically give it the land to you, to kind of create a new mini or nested municipality. Example of a squatting story that I heard at a conference by a speaker. It was, of course, in Europe. This is where squatters' rights actually exist. So if you do squat in a place long enough, you kind of have a case. Here in America, we seem to have no such thing. A group of people, activists, in a similar way of Chaz or Chop, took over a abandoned school. And they started turning it into that kind of artist commune slash community center. Got power back, water, they fixed it up. You know, they had to fight the city who wanted to kick them out because, hey, it belongs to the city. But the city wasn't using it, so we're going to use it. And they started investing labor and money into it. So there's a case of, you know, mixing labor with property. The property should be yours. I wish this actually carried over into America, which it doesn't. You know, you could squat and fix up to the point of, you know, limited to not getting water and electricity into a vacant house. But, you know, if I fix up a vacant house on my own and do enough repairs, but I don't get ownership of it, it's still owned by whatever vacant absentee landlord, or let's say it's the city or something like that. I don't have permission. Yeah, and then he moves on to, and then he just wraps up by just saying, like, we need real autonomous zones, like Hong Kong. Or autonomous zones where, you know, people with the capital can do whatever they want. Free zones. Usually called opportunity zones, so you know the buzzwords to look out for. Designating a district, perhaps in cooperation with currently designated opportunity zones, which already exist, right? Usually giving tax exemption, exempt from a range of land use, schooling, policing, and related policies, importing ideas from the charter city concept, which is, so it's basically like charter schools, but now let's do it with entire swaths of the city. That'll fix urban social issues. Not. And with that, I'll wrap up the, so maybe I probably don't have enough time. But I have some more general notes here. So in talking about Chaz or Chop and the act of resistance to being organized. Long time ago, I don't remember exact year, but I have a book called A Middle American Individuality. It was written in the 80s, I think, or late 80s. And it was mostly about, you know, so it's from the perspective of talking about Americans born after 1970, Gen Xers going forward. The book itself is about how those born in, you know, and younger, are distrustful of organizations, large or small, whether it be a self-run one or a large social club, political parties. These are all of the 20th century, the main 20th century social unit. What do we have in the 21st century? We seem to have friend groups. We have the social network, which is decentralized, but also completely disorganized. How hard it is to work with strangers is a particular question to me. That we are able to work on specific tasks in mutual aid approach. But can this become organizations that are, can be more actionable? But the general question and concern is that isn't an organization generally just going to become a little more than human resource management. This is what people fear. You know, I join an organization and I'm going to be managed like every other organization that actually exists in my world, which is the state and the corporation. Completely hierarchical, top-down, alienating, disempowering. So we're distrustful over organizations. Not just Zoomers, but pretty much anyone born after 1970, after Watergate. This seems to be a general thing. I'm not going to say it's a problem. It's an existence. It's like it's how things are. And that our strategies are still kind of based in the 20th century, building up parties, forming organizations, trying to create things that existed in the past, but can only be in their run by boomers, people who grew up in the 20th century when there were these trustworthy organizations, these social clubs, you know, the Elks, the Freemasons, the League of Veterans Associations. Occupy had a horizontal model, but even this was resisted by many who joined the Occupy movement to actually be part of an organization, to join a working group. We kind of weeded out people who were kind of grifting Occupy by actually requiring people to join a working group, to actually be part of the horizontal organization that was maybe forming. But there was a lot of resistance to that. That was tyrannical. You know, my observation with the current movement is that there is not one organization or group. You may have noticed this, but there are 10 of them. Like here in Albany, I've counted at least 5. There's this Vox Noir, Black Voices group. There's All of Us. There's one called Vocal. It's an acronym. Don't know what it stands for yet. I'll learn. There's a number of groups. All of them organizing their own protests, which kind of helps it be more of a rolling thing where there's a protest every other day. And so no one gets completely burned out, overloaded, right? But how much collaboration is happening? It doesn't seem to be there yet. They may be talking to each other. I don't know. Could a coalition form? Is it even possible? Are we nice enough? Because all of these groups have their toxic members. For example, one of them, the Vox Noir, they were toxic towards us Green Party people. We not only showed up to their protests as allies, you know, we didn't talk over them, we didn't even ask to speak. It wasn't our place. We don't need a cookie, okay? We, in fact, actually asked them, what can we do for you? And they asked, well, donate some money, provide supplies, donate signs. We did all that. We made them 50 signs. But this was just our little caveat. We put a little bug logo, Green Party, Upper Hudson Green Party on them. They were Black Lives Matter signs. But there was $100 that we just gave them. And there was the supplies as well, water and stuff. And when we dropped the signs off, or at least our chair did, they're like, we're not going to accept these. You're trying to take over the movement with your little logo in the corner there. Rebrand the movement. No, we're not branding. And they basically just told us to F off. That's what it came down to. And pretty disrespectful and also not coalition building. Wonderful. Because it's kind of pretty toxic, right? Maybe it's a conversation to have. Because really, what they are is what I've observed, like with the, Albany United is another one, that it just seems to be a group of friends or a group of colleagues that know each other and know other people. But, like, is a bigger organizational, horizontal organization going to be made? Unlikely. Why? No one has the education to create one. I feel like I've made one, or I have the education, but I've yet to produce because I've just been alone. To me, the Green Party kind of is the horizontal organization that I'm part of, more or less. Doesn't always act like a horizontal one, but it's also because we don't have enough people to make that work. You know, you don't have a working group system if you don't even have enough for one committee, or you have enough people for a committee for the whole county. Now, Occupy had a horizontal model, but it was resisted, and it had the weaknesses of, you know, the kind of failures of its meeting structure. That books have been written on that. And the boundaries of membership. And that's what I was mentioning right before the break, that we were starting to finally put a boundary in place of, look, we'll allow you to be, quote unquote, a member of this intentional community at Zuccotti Park, Freedom Plaza, but you need to join a working group. You need to plug in. We're not going to serve you food unless you're actively part of some project. That means being educated on how things work here, learning, being open to learning, and then thus learning the rules that we're forming together, and they're very loose rules, and simple stuff. But it kept things from being completely discombobulated and vulnerable to outside interference. But that was only in the last 2 weeks of Occupy Wall Street. These are all issues that come up when it comes to anarchist praxis that I don't really hear good solutions for from solid, hardcore anarchists. Now, where the answers come from is where you kind of join anarchist ideas with general socialist ones, and you get the ideologies and the thinking that creates Rojava, Chiapas in Mexico, those things. This kind of evolved form of socialism that's more libertarian, that is horizontal. But there are always these patterns of mistrust or trust, hair splitting, personal holdups, the biases people have, bad not a good cooperative culture because we're so unused to cooperating with strangers, I think is the thing. We can cooperate with friends, so the friend groups can come out and do single tasks in their free time. But when it comes to working with strangers or being part of a larger group that has strangers, people you don't know in it, and you don't, like, there's a mistrust of, like, who's a good actor? Who isn't a good actor? Maybe this person's an undercover cop. Or maybe they're, like, just some messed up person. You don't know who they are, so they could be abusive. You don't know them. But this is where, like, putting boundaries to membership come into play. If someone is a due-paying member of Green Party, that's a level of commitment that most, say, bad faith actors will not have. But does this mean, like, any Zoomer, just to use that term, anyone under the age of 24 will be ever open to joining some kind of organization? I have the observation that there are these groups of friends that are naming themselves and then doing their own thing based on their own preferences or biases. Quick aside about the experience of CAMI here in Albany. Now, in Albany, we have all these new formed groups that are part of the new Black Lives Matter movement, but we don't have a Black Lives Matter fully formed chapter in Albany, at least not an active one. Why? Because in the first iteration of this movement, there was a Black Lives Matter chapter, as well as as a group called CAMI that was Capital Area Against Mass Incarceration. But what happened was two of the members of that group, solid 10 people or so, they were dating, and then there was a messy breakup. And then the group fractured along that breakup of, like, do they take the girls, the ladies' side or the guys' side? It wasn't a political disagreement. It wasn't over tactics or strategy. It was personal dramas. Pretty pathetic, right? I'm not telling the whole story. I don't know the whole story. I'm literally referencing it third hand. But it's the kind of things that happen. Okay, so I'll come back to my last note with this. So then it becomes a question of, like, this revolution, this big organization, the how to do massive political change, right? Kind of becomes one of the questions of the left over the last 100 years and longer, is this binary that, of course, is not really binary, but a matter of preference of what is a chosen strategy of the party or unions. So in terms of ideology or isms, they're called vanguardism if you're focused on the party, which is, like, you know, political leadership, and unions, which is then called syndicalism or trade unionism, because if you have enough unions in various areas, they form a syndicate and then have the ability, organizationally or otherwise, to actually manage the economy, or not the whole economy, but then what I meant was, phrasing I found was, to take on functions of the market. to do things that markets do, like set prices, allocate resources efficiently. And so the way political change has occurred in the past is that you have both. So it's not an either or. Just like earlier, there's not reform or revolution. They go together. You do both. They rely on each other. Parties require a base of support, which comes in the form of unions and other social organization around identity, around whatever. Parties then are just the conduit or the platform of then doing the social, the political change on the state level. So I do not discount unionism. I am not in unionism. I'm not doing worker organizing, but I do party organizing because I feel like eventually unions should be able to take power for themselves and not just give money to Democrats but then stab them in the back, which has occurred in my lifetime since that 1970 when organizations stopped being trusted. Wonder why. Whether they be unions, social clubs, parties, whatever, they're all distrusted. Unless it's with your friends. And then your friends form a group, but then you got the personal dramas that could happen. It's almost like you remove that by making things more dispassionate by only organizing with strangers, not with friends. But in the 21st century, maybe that's the most appropriate thing. The only way we do organize is with our friends. And then friends of friends, and then the social network that is kind of exists can then be this greater mass. But then what does that mass do? Right? Just, it can go into the streets. We saw that happen for a week where we got many hundreds of thousands of people out into the streets. And look at all the cultural change we're getting. We're not getting any economic or political change, but cultural change, symbolic change, statues, whatever, you know, history debates.
Thank you.
So here's from New Zealand, of all places. Publication called The Spinoff. This was linked a weird place, published in April. It's called Are You Ready for Radical Change? Really? So this is written by a moderate who's kind of asking the skeptical questions of the left, but also doing a book review of a book that I didn't even realize was released, but going in the Wayback Machine. Back in 2012 or so, there was Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century. We had post-Occupy book readings of this, book discussions, public meetups about discussing this book. I didn't read it. I thought it was kind of like not addressing the questions we have, but some other nerds wanted to. He's written a new one. That's what he's been doing the last few years. So here's a tagline from a Daryl McLachlan. For all his petitions and protests, the left is too invested in its own privilege to upend quote-unquote hyper-capitalism. Thomas Piketty argues in his latest book, Capital and Ideology, so it's time to conjure something new. It is a very long book. I started it sometime in late December when the electoral defeat of the British Labour Party still reverberated around the world and finally finished Tom Piketty's Capital and Ideology, his sequel, sort of, to Capital in the 21st Century in early April, under lockdown, as the coronavirus pandemic collapsed the global economy. The book speaks to these events with an eerie prescience. Where did UK Labour go wrong? And more broadly, what happened to the left, or center-left, as a political intellectual movement, and what does it stand for now? But it is a broad left that can be referred to here, I guess. And that's the only way to understand things at the moment, maybe, that this article does, which I'm kind of conflicted with, but still kind of, like, find useful is, like, I'm very hesitant to refer to a broad left that includes the Democrats and it includes me in it. But sometimes when you have the far left, you know, actual communists talking about things and talking about how they need to be more intellectually rigorous, that kind of goes for everybody. Moving on. Back in 2008, in the wake of global financial crisis, the global left felt validated, optimistic. They had been right all along. The economy was rigged. The system was a fraud. Now everyone could see it. It was time for radical, transformational change, time to move beyond the neoliberal paradigm. As a thousand Guardian op-eds put it, time for a fairer, more compassionate society to rise from the ashes of a crisis. But none of that happened. Instead, electoral support for left-wing parties, whether they be center-left or more left, more radical, collapsed around the world. There was still some left-wing governments, referring to center-left, by the way. Barack Obama was the first black president, but they were mostly centrist, honest. A handful of radical left governments rose during the euro crisis, but then fell again, mostly because they were constrained by the entire economic system. Nothing really changed, and voters increasingly preferred right-wing authoritarian populism, fascism, pseudo-fascism. The failed campaigns of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn in late 2019 and early 2020 seemed to signify the death of the progressive left's decade of hope. What happened? And now that the world is rapidly plunging into even deeper crisis, what is to be done? The fox knows many things, the old saying goes, while the hedgehog knows one big thing. Piketty's big thing is inequality. It is the central problem of economics and the defining feature of every human society. None of us deserve to be born into rich families or poor families, or rich countries or poor countries. Yet almost all of our opportunities, our health, our access to education, and our success, failure in life derive from an accident of birth. You may or may not recall that Capital in the 21st Century argued that inequality was built to the economic logic of capitalism, operating via laws of capital. This was something that was pretty much figured out by Marx already, but at least, you know, it's an update. It's always good to update. But this is a law of capital that Piketty uncovered in vast repositories of historical data. The most famous of these was R is greater than G. Over the long term, the rate of return on capital is greater than economic growth, which meant that in a capitalist economy, those who owned things would gradually grow richer than those who worked. But Piketty no longer seems to think this is true. Now he argues that inequality is a social phenomenon, a result of choices a society makes about who owns what and why. Is driven not by immutable laws or other impersonal historical forces, but by institutions, politics, and legal systems. And the value judgments embedded in them, judgments that have always presented as sensible or inevitable, but are always socially constructed. Now I'm going to stop, but I'm going to pause to point out this is the only problematic paragraph that I found in this article that I actually have to kind of talk about. So it's like, it was a critique I almost had of Hickney the first round when he published his other Capital in the 21st Century, his magnum opus, that he seemed to ignore social forces. Now, at least as far as the interpretation of this moderate writer in New Zealand, he seems to be going the other direction and saying it's all socially constructed. Now, there is a term in social sciences, which economists like Pinckney don't seem to read at all, which is weird. But the term is a hyphenated one, socio-political. I used it already in this episode when I was reading an anarchist piece. Why? Because we read social science and they have the term socio-political. Hyphenated terms like that are kind of necessary to kind of talk about things so you're not falling into this either-or trap of it's either all the laws of economics, like it's physics, or it's all socially constructed and meaningless. It's both of those things, right? These things like the things listed in this paragraph here, politics and legal systems, those are influenced by who has most money, and those would be those who earn more holding capital than working, which is represented by economic growth. And that can only continue as long as there's enough wages to pay out to people. But with the declining rate of profit since the 70s, since, our current era started, we've been in an era of declining rate of profit. That means there's less wages to go around. Some of it can go to the hyper-rich, billionaires, but as far as our economic system is concerned, it cannot distribute wages far enough, wide enough, or just enough per person. That is why there is talk of universal basic income, of just distributing wages, not in a form based on work, but based on existence. Or why currently, to make up for the fact for the pandemic and the really drop in profitability, unemployment benefits are going out like gangbusters. It's a constant thing being mentioned in economic analysis in the news. Not only do you get back economic unemployment benefits in the thousands, you then get the $600 a week. People are making more on unemployment than they were working. No duh, because work is not profitable, because you cannot make enough value in the marketplace, in the capitalist economy, because the rate of profitability keeps going down. Work is worth less, and so the wages can never be equal, and that's why raising wages with minimum wage laws, by if it, it needs to in order to actually live, it needs to be $25 an hour needs to be the minimum. But that's, as far as the market's concerned, impossible. And since it is, so too is our system. Impossible. It can't continue. But I went on that rant just to point out that society and economy are interlinked. They're the same thing. They're not to be studied. They can be studied separately, right? But they actually shouldn't be. That's kind of where, like, just writing a book about economics and then now Pinckney writes just about societies. It seems to be binary. He can only do one thing at a time, even though he goes really deep into it. For example, moving on with the article, the first 600 pages of the book, it is over 1,000 pages long, consists of Pinckney's description of all human history. He begins with territory societies. These were pre-modern, mostly feudal orders, lacking in a strong central state. They are divided into three main classes: nobility, a warrior caste that kept order, clergy, which would also meant a priestly or intellectual class that provided education and spiritual guidance, or purpose, or the narrative for the society, and the workers who did all the manual labor. The first two groups were the ruling class. Now, this is a statement by the writer here I don't agree with. They were not parasitical, Pinckney argues. On the contrary, they created enormous value, and that's where the inequality comes from. The ruling class can establish a monopoly on all this high status, high value. Oh, sorry. I thought I disagreed with it, but actually it is a pretty accurate statement that the ruling class at the time created enormous value that then they had in terms of power, bankable power. High-value positions introduce laws that wield political, religious, or cultural power, and they can build an ideology justifying their choices as natural and necessary, warning that to deviate from them would destroy society. See any argument that conservatives make about anything. You see, it's the same basic structure in pre-modern China, India, and Japan, repeating itself throughout the modern era. He examines slave economies, colonialism, post-colonialism, post-revolutionary France, early industrial capitalism, communist states of the 20th century. All of these, he argues, were inequality regimes, societies in which elites captured key political, legal, educational, cultural institutions, locked in their privilege, and then constructed an ideology justification system that massively benefited them. For all his disdain for Marxism, Piketty's ideas here are not a million miles away. They are, in fact, the same ideas of mid-20th century Marxist theorists, the dreaded cultural Marxists. Although Piketty can explain in a handful of brief sentences what Adorno and Gramsci struggled to communicate over hundreds of dense pages. I don't get this take by the writer because, by the author, because it's a 1,000-page book. It's not, he's also taking hundreds of pages to explain it. Adorno and Gramsci, check them out. He spends a long time looking at revolutionary failure, especially in the Soviet Union and post-revolutionary France. The revolution can overthrow an elite class, the church, capitalists, aristocrats, the czar, but it never solves the deep problem of elite capture, and it generally makes it much worse, or at least the same. Instead of separate systems governed by rival elite factions, which often keep each other in check, so a little boost for liberal democracy, the revolution centralizes everything under a single elite party, or the party, ruling through a cruel and unaccountable bureaucratic state. Way to see only the negatives, dude. The heroes of Piketty's grand history and theory of everything are the mid-20th century social democracies. They are general democracy, whatever, popular workers' parties, powerful trade unions, and yes, okay, sorry, I'm going to stop reading disdainfully. This is all pretty accurate, actually, and to the point. Social democracy worked, Piketty argues, at least for 30 years, but it failed to properly deliver on its convictions, and by the late 20th century, the project was intellectually exhausted. But isn't social democracy pretty much what the contemporary left stands for? Wasn't Bernie and Jeremy social democrats? Isn't that the same ideology that's losing elections all around the world? It is not, Piketty replies. Left-wing parties have the same names as those of mid-20th century social democratic organizations, but the parties themselves were radically different, and that is the main subject of the second half of the book. So then he goes into kind of a same story, but different terms that I've kind of talked about in previous episodes, but here it is. But here's the thing where this liberal democracy is still an inequality society, because here's what happened when social democracy won in the mid-20th century, won through massive struggle. But what happened was there were also winners of social democracy that rose up. They became enfranchised, voting for political parties that empowered them. But as the graph continues into the 80s, we enter the period that Piketty calls hypercapitalism. It's not just him, other people call it. But everyone else calls it neoliberalism. Society becomes a lot more unequal. Educated elites become a lot wealthier than everyone else, and they separate into two broad factions that Piketty refers to as the merchant right and the Brahmin left. The merchant right is just the right, much as it has been for 100 years. The Brahmin left is a newer phenomenon consisting primarily of educated, higher-income public sector workers. Academia, obviously, but most of the media, rest of the culture industry. In policy terms, the Brahmin left wants to raise taxes on their higher-income rivals in the merchant right and spend the money on more white-collar public sector jobs, more funding for tritary education, more money for cultural stuff. Meanwhile, the working class, the people who left-wing political parties congratulate themselves for representing, are electorally homeless. Fewer and fewer of them bother to vote. When they do, they increasingly vote for the right. All elites need an ideological justification for their privilege, Merchant Wright argues that free market outcomes are moral, that they've worked hard for their money. But most of the Brahmin left tells itself that it is not the elite. Instead, they see themselves as victims of capitalism or other forms of structural oppression. They view their lives, which are utopian in global terms, as deeply traumatizing dystopian nightmares. So here's where I get confused about, like, who is this Brahmin left? Am I included, or all of the activists I know and the people in the streets, are they the Brahmin left? Kinda? Like, are they? Is everyone on the left, even the extreme left? Like, the parties that I'm in, you know, are we the Brahmin left? This is where, like, I get a little uncomfortable. Like, to be grouped in the same sphere of class as the Democratic Party operatives who shun me, who don't want anything to do with me. Because that's actually the reference person who shunned the Green Party signs. We know them as someone who, maybe not at the moment, but worked in the Democratic Party orbit. Or maybe they're just used to thinking in those terms of, are they in the Democratic Party orbit or not? If they're not, not working with them. If they are, they're a possible ally. That's who we build a coalition with. Because, hey, if they're in the orbit of the Democratic Party, they have access, or they are the actual elected people that we want to put pressure on. It's still a movement that is based around getting something from the current power structure and not changing it, not taking it over or not actually getting a piece of it, which, let's say, Green Party actually becomes successful, we'll get a piece of it. You know, we're not going to elect the whole Congress or something. But let's continue there. But the Brahmin left do not actually want to change things because they are massively privileged by the status quo. So much of their political activism takes the form of online protests or symbolic cultural conflicts. This worldview is not very coherent. So much of the Brahmin left consumes vast amounts of propaganda to reassure itself of their status as victims and their high moral and intellectual self-worth. So this description then makes me rethink what I just said. As I remind myself, there are these kind of the liberal feminists, the Democratic Party insiders, that do see themselves this way, that do act this way, you know, the people who are called the left in mainstream politics, but I would call center left or the center even. The liberals, you know, the difference between a liberal and a leftist. So to me, the Brahmin left describes this description of them, describes liberals, or what I call, you know, what I would, me and other leftists like me call liberals, to differentiate ourselves, to say we're not like them. We actually had come at things a Marxian way, like the current leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement. Some of them are Marxists. They're black Marxists. They see things. They're like, we're just as anti-capitalist as we are anti-white supremacy, because they are linked. They're practically the same thing. Just like Malcolm X said. That's what Malcolm X was about, so on and so forth. Because, hell, MLK, Malcolm X, all the civil rights leaders, they were socialists. Let's remember that. Over the past decade, right-wing political parties around the world have been able to win low-income voters, the white working class, at first, but increasingly numbers of ethnic minorities, by shifting to the center on economic issues while activating nationalist sentiments and framing the modern left as class enemies of the poor. Because as far as the liberal class is concerned, they are. Democratic Party. And the 2019 UK election was the collision of all these trends. The Social Democratic Party was captured and championed by upper-class crackpots who deluded themselves into thinking they were radicals and revolutionaries, but who openly despised their less educated, more proletarian class inferiors. And here's where then I think of, like, this, the new left, the dirtbag left, the DSA left, like the people who are becoming more leftist. Champions of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn and electing, you know, still going to the mainstream party to take it over or to make it more social democratic and failing miserably. So this takes a kind of, you know, more top-down view that they're going to fail from the start because they are, in fact, of a different class than the people that they are actually trying to get votes from, to inspire. The result was a catastrophic loss of both the white working class and black and Asian voters. The only electorate Corbyn's Labour Party captured was a wealthy, predominantly white suburb in West London. Sounds like exaggeration, but not really. I'm going to skip this paragraph that includes referencing Orwell, because Orwell was all about fighting for a socialism that was more nationalistic, and because Orwell was a social democrat at the end of the day. So Piketty's diagnosis points to a similar problem, but his solution is a lot more intellectual. Capital and Ideology advocates for what he calls, and what I've heard a few other places, participatory socialism. It's another name for everything that I talk about. The two key ideas attached to this are social property and temporary property. There's no justification for the sacred nature of modern property rights, he argues. It's just another excuse for inequality, another elite fabrication. True! Social property means mandatory representation of workers on corporate boards, while temporary property means an end to large inheritances and a confiscatory level of taxation on large fortunes, so that marginal tax rate of 90% on the very rich. Everyone gets an equal education payment, a basic income, universal capital grant of about $200,000 at the age of 25, so they can go buy a house. And Piketty assures the reader that there are still vast amounts of wealth left to decarbonize the economy. Now, I would counter that decarbonizing is not enough to make our economy sustainable, but whatever. But this would be what 21st century social democracy looks like. That you still have corporate top-down structures, but at least everyone actually has representation on them. Workers, meaning. So that you have a management class. You still have a management class and a working class, but the idea is so that they at least have equal decision-making power. Not the more socialist vision of every worker being a manager, at least of themselves and their work group. The 10-person mutual aid, you know, social network, decentralized thing, which my vision of socialism more looks like. So there are differences, but this is the social, like, this to me would be the compromise. And probably more doable as far as what American society is like now. So that's where the intellectual rigor comes in of, like, what can we actually change now and would be workable? Worker representation on corporate boards is doable right now. Like, you don't have to retrain everybody or re-educate people on how to manage their workplace. But that can come in time. That's something that's kind of necessary for organizations to work. There needs to be a level of education. Not the type of education that comes from, like, a college degree, but I mean, like, the type of education described in Rojava, where when you participate in the self-defense force or the police unit, you get a full crash course in consensus decision-making, in the history of capitalism, and all kinds of things, problem-solving, a lot of stuff. So that you're not a yes man or a soldier that takes orders without question, and you don't get evil abuse stuff. Moving on. Participatory socialism would have to become a broad-based movement to succeed, but what Piketty is trying to do with this book, I think, is to create a vanguard for that movement, to call into being a radical left that is, and here's where I don't like these words, technocratic, data-driven, and intellectually rigorous. Well, I like the intellectually rigorous. That's mentioned in left-wing circles like Zero books a lot, that we need to be more into Rolling Stone with Matt Taibbi, that there needs to be a more intellectually rigorous left, that we're constantly not having good explanations for why things happen, why things the way they are. His project is emancipatory, focusing on the liberation of the poorest from material poverty. It is not revolutionary because the revolution always fails. It is not Marxist because the core tenets of that ideology are wrong in ways that have been obvious for over a century. Piketty's vision of a new radical left is not even especially anti-capitalist, because under his model of economic mode of production, does not actually matter very much. Capital is a little more than an accounting term. Capital being an accounting term is true, but the mode of production, I would argue, does matter. In fact, it's what any actual leftist does. This is where Piketty, just like Orwell, just a social democrat, not a leftist like me, but still, like, that's the compromise. That's, like, that's what's doable. But here's where this author is pretty honest, and I like that, where he kind of redeems a little bit. I'm a member of this Brahmin left, a bit a low-ranking member of that caste. I have an advanced degree and work at a university and review books by Thomas Pinketty. And when I consider the final sections of Capital and Ideology, I can simultaneously accept what Pinketty is saying about the modern left and acknowledge why everyone else hates us, yet feel very defensive of my class and its values. Our current prime minister is a centrist technocratic elite. And look how nice she is and how well that's going, you know, with their low coronavirus rates. But radical change is here now, whether anyone wants it or not. Pinketty has been in the media since the outbreak of the pandemic and the collapse of global markets. He's optimistic that the window of what is politically possible can change and change quickly at times like these, that his movement can rise, that radical social and economic transformation is still possible, and that something good can come of all this suffering, and we can build a better world from the ruins of the old. I hope he's right, and that centrists like me turn out to be wrong. So I find that amazingly interesting. To wrap that up with a, let's see, with my last note, that of Les's conversations of usually when analyzing the left in, you know, 1960 moving forward, that the, from the leftist intellectual point of view, where they're trying to analyze like what has gone wrong or just talking about revolution, well, like the working class has failed to do it. So what now? What do we do then? What then? You know, what if revolution does? If revolution doesn't come from the working class, does it come from this Brahmin left? Of course not. Does it come from emerging classes that are coming about right now? What kind of classes will emerge post-pandemic, post-global crisis that we're in and will continue to be in for the next few years, at least? Maybe it'll be ongoing. Maybe it'll never end. Or it'll turn into something else, obviously. Do we even organize at all? Do we just do things in our social networks? The last 40 years, we've had an activist left. They've won a lot of small victories. There's been a lot of things that have happened. But there has not been any broad movement or broad political or economic change brought from the left. Is it just an education problem? This is kind of why I do this podcast. This is, to me, an education project. More direct, though, would be me and others doing teach-ins for all of these new Black Lives Matter groups. Occupy did teach-ins, and they were great. There were teach-ins about all sorts of topics, particularly with the working group facilitation and so on. There were teach-ins on how to do it, on how to do consensus. In fact, every assembly was a teach-in on consensus. To observe how to do it, to take part in it. So thus it was lecture, workshop, practical learning, all at the same time. It wasn't adapted to every type of learning style. That's what something else to take into account. But it's definitely something to think about, that in order to have a movement that can act collectively, and I keep saying this, we gotta need to be on the same page, but what does that mean? Right? Are people willing to submit to a ad hoc education process, to participate in the next autonomous zone, to be a member of it, to actually have a membership in the first place? Chrislandia has 900 residents. They have rules that they follow and they make together. So do a lot of other intentional communities. They have memberships, usually based on residency. What if we did that in our own neighborhoods? But that requires a kind of commitment that I'm not moving, right? What if you're renting there? What if you're evicted? What if you have to move suddenly? What if a family emergency comes? It can't really just be based on place. Not as the economy functions now, but maybe the self-transformation comes in where we transform things by acting against that grain, by staying put, by putting down roots. Seems like the only place you can build an intentional community is out in farmland. The ones that last seem to be, you know, farming communities. Or even if they're just really intensive gardening, they make some handicrafts or they sell some things. They interact with the economy a little bit. Not completely autonomous. Nothing has to be completely autonomous. There's nothing that's completely off-grid. Like, what are the younger people willing to do? Especially when their political education seems to be in the form of going on Facebook pages and asking kind of good questions, pertinent questions, of the faceless mass that is the rest of the Facebook group. It's not face-to-face. It's all with strangers. So maybe there is hope. You have all these random teenagers willing to learn basic political science, basic politics, really. Basic ideology, you know. Just asking basic questions, going on the anarchism page. What's anarchism like? How does an anarchism system work? YouTube videos are made on these topics with these basic educational questions. And they get lots of views. They get lots of likes. So maybe people are willing to learn from strangers. Though with YouTubers, you build a parasocial relationship, it's called, where you feel like you're friends with someone that you watch all the time. You get to know them, or at least their character. It's got to be with the people who are on the outside of my circles, my social network. They have to be strangers. The random conversations. These are what occurred in Occupy, and they likely occurred in the Chaz, or the Chop. The spontaneity, the randomness, the unplannedness, the fact that it was unorganized. But the dangers that occur in organizations that have, well, gatekeeping. It's something like there are these particular aspects or things that are abuses or viewed as tyrannical or type of unjustified hierarchy. And then we strive so hard to avoid them, we end up creating other unsolvable problems. I feel like if we kind of head on, took on the gatekeeping problem, we could create hierarchies that are justifiable, that are horizontal enough, shared power, good consensus decision making, reduces the gatekeeping, but have a minimum level for membership. Maybe it's not residence, of course, as I discussed. Maybe it's just educational level, but that's classes as hell. But by education level, I mean like we're doing a class, and in order to take part, and you know, certain co-ops, to be a co-op, a local co-op, you know, to be a worker owner, you need to do a orientation. It's like 3 hours or 2 hours, whatever it is. And it's basically a rundown. It's like going through some PowerPoints. Pretty simple. Don't really need to do intensive workshops or exercises. But let's say to do consensus, you didn't do need to do that, to do go through a consensus workshop, maybe facilitate a meeting yourself. Got to lead before you can do. No, sorry, got to do before you can lead. And I certainly took that on myself while in Occupy. I took part of assemblies for a better part of a month. And then the next year, I took on learning how to facilitate, because I could see the problems or the weaknesses of the facilitation team at Occupy Wall Street. Because there are all these weaknesses that everyone kind of were aware about. You know, the lack of cutting people off, not having a time limit, not having enough rules at all, and also not having any barriers to participation, which allowed all kinds of kooks and blockers and people to kind of sabotage. There's almost a self-sabotage of, I don't trust organizations, and then so if I'm going to join an organization, my first instinct is to ruin it. I see this in the Green Party a little bit, where there are these Jesse Ventura fans. They've joined the Green Party just to get Jesse Ventura on the ballot. He's not running for president. He has said he's not running for president, yet they continue to make it all about them and their cause and making the party bend to their whim. Saying that we're corrupt if we don't give them what they want. They are just a small group. They have, by being members, but see, our line for joining and voting in our primary is just registering green. It's a low bar. It's filling out one paper form. You don't have to be a dues-paying member. You just have to be a registered green. And for this, they voted in our primaries, and Jesse Ventura, despite not being a candidate, has 2-3 delegates. And for this, they call for a disputed convention, that you know, the convention should be reorganized. Howie needs to drop out, and so they can give the give the nomination to Jesse Ventura, because they so strongly believe that Jesse Ventura is the right candidate for the Green Party, that he would be our best spokesperson, but also that he's the only thing that makes us viable. because running celebrities is what makes a party viable. Completely misunderstanding what the point of a political party is, what having a political organization is for, what it means to actually be democratic. It's hilarious. Frustrating, but also an example of the broader problems. So with that, I will wrap up with the housekeeping. First, my profound thanks for listening, an important skill as important as talking. So I plan to listen to any constructive feedback sent in, ideas for the show, or stories or topics you'd like to hear discussed. Capitalists and sadists alike don't believe work like mine is worth paying a living wage. But you can by supporting the show via my Patreon page. Support with your time by telling others you believe would be interested to like and share our Facebook and Twitter posts and pages. All found by searching Three Left Show on those platforms. The last 10 episodes are broadcast on all or most podcasting apps, and a full archive of shows and show notes with them. Info about myself are found at 3left.news, as well as links to listen to WCAA, the live stream, as well as the archive of this and other episodes and all of our content. Of course, the most important thing is to put the ideas and thinking and projects talked about here in practice yourself. Thanks, until next time, keep waving the flags of the three lefts.